This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Gunners, a novel by Rebecca Kaufman. This book is read by Michael David Axtell. For we live with those retrievals from childhood that coalesce and echo throughout our lives, the way shattered pieces of glass in a kaleidoscope reappear in new forms and are song-like in their refrains and rhymes, making up a single monologue. We live permanently in the recurrence of our own stories, whatever story we tell. Michael Ondaatje, Divisadero. Chapter 1. Mikey Callahan discovered something about himself when he was 6 years old. Students from his first grade class were taken one at a time from the classroom and ushered to the gymnasium for standard medical tests. The woman who barked his name, although she called for Michael instead of Mikey as his classmates knew him, held his hand as she walked him down the hall, and her fingers were as dry and cool as a husk. In the gymnasium there were rectangular tables, screens, clipboards, grown-ups dressed in white. A man with a rust-colored mustache put a cold rubber point into Mikey's ears, stared in at them, and led him through a series of easy tests, instructing Mikey to close his eyes and repeat words the man whispered, then listen to two recorded tones and tell him which was louder. Mikey proceeded to the next station, where he was asked once again to close his eyes and say now when he detected that he had been touched, on his face or his arm, by the tip of a pen. Easy. Mikey liked this better than sitting in a classroom, and he enjoyed being touched in this way. Gentle. Clinical. At the final station, an easel at the far end of a long table displayed a white piece of paper with a pyramid of black letters on it. A woman stood next to the paper and pointed at letters one at a time, and Mikey read the letters back to her. The letters got smaller as she moved down the page, and he struggled to read the final two rows. The woman made a note on her clipboard, then she handed him a black plastic spoon and asked him to cover his left eye with it. She replaced the set of letters with a fresh one and repeated the exercise, with similar results. She said, "Cover your other eye now," and turned the page on her easel once again. Mikey did not raise the spoon to his face. He felt the heat of dark blood spreading up into his cheeks. He said, "But that's my good one." The lady said, "What now, hon?" "I can't cover this one." He gestured toward his right eye, puzzled by her request. "It's the one that works." The lady came and knelt before him. She looked at his face and said, "Oh, dear." Mikey didn't understand. She explained to him that both eyes were supposed to work. Most people had two good eyes. Mikey nodded slowly as he considered this. He had a compulsion to nod when faced with unpleasant information. He said, "Please, let's not tell my dad." When Mikey got home from school that day, his father stared at his left eye, the bad one, with a look of mild distaste. Then he led Mikey through a series of his own tests, as though the school had exaggerated the condition. He made Mikey close his right eye and tell him how many fingers he was holding up. Mikey tried to answer correctly, fluttering his right eye open to peek. He begged his father not to make him wear a patch like a pirate, and his father said, "What in the hell would that accomplish?" His father told him he must make the decision, right at that moment, whether the world would know about the left eye, or whether it would be Mikey's secret. And he seemed relieved when Mikey quickly answered that it would be his secret, as though the condition, if known by others, would in some way reflect poorly upon both of them. They didn't speak of it again. Mikey's father worked for the meatpacking facility in Eden, several towns over. He always smelled of blood, and had red in the corners of his fingernails, carrying with him the insinuation of violence, brute force. His face was lumpy, as though it had been stuffed full. His eyes drooped. For Mikey's entire childhood, The two of them lived in the first floor of a townhouse on Ingram Street in Lackawanna, a depressed suburb of South Buffalo. Only half the homes on their block were occupied. The others had boards for windows, liquor bottles smashed into the front porches, stray cats shitting in overgrown lawns. The upstairs tenants in their townhouse wore slippers to the store and always smelled vaguely sulfuric, and they engaged in monthly screaming arguments with the landlord over late rent and threats of eviction. Mikey's father always paid rent on time, but sometimes he forgot about the utilities, and a man in Navy would show up demanding a cash payment, saying that if they couldn't pay, he'd pull the plug on their house, and then how would they see at night? What would they eat? Mikey's father ate four things: cereal, apples, white bread with cold cuts, and Chips Ahoy cookies. Mikey was not introduced to other foods until he was offered them by his friends from their lunchboxes or by his friends' mothers in their homes. Mikey did not have a mother of his own, and because his father refused to provide any information on this matter, Mikey took it upon himself to search their home for clues. He looked for things he had seen in the homes of his friends belonging to their mothers: a ball of pantyhose, or a shoe with a pointy heel, long lists written in cursive, a little plastic basket filled with nail polish, or a box of Tampax beneath the sink, an apron with roosters or reindeer embroidered onto it. He recovered not one piece of hard evidence in his own home. On one occasion, however, Mikey discovered a single item that didn't fit in his home. It wasn't quite right. It was a small suitcase located in the corner of his father's closet, beneath a stack of neatly folded sweaters in various shades of gray. The suitcase was tacky and bright. It was the only thing in their entire home that Mikey simply could not imagine his father purchasing. When Mikey opened the suitcase, the scent of the cobalt blue lining inside tickled at a memory, as faint and far away and indistinct as a single puff of smoke. Maybe a memory of a memory. Even so, Mikey began to wonder if he had not been born out of a lady's peeing hole, like his friends, but had simply arrived in this suitcase, which was perfectly sized to hold a small child and vaguely womb-like in its shape. Mikey had no proof that this suitcase had produced him, but as a young boy it was his most persistent theory, and he liked to open the thing and stroke its strange synthetic fur and imagine that life had begun in this soft blue place. Mikey's father was a man of dark and quiet emotions. Things were rarely horrible between Mikey and his father, at least not in the usual ways. Things were not vicious or unbearable, but things were never easy. Mikey's father had bad knees and bad moods, a shadowy disposition. He drank too often, daily, but rarely too much in a single sitting. Mikey never once saw him stumble or slur or fall asleep upright in a chair. When Mikey was a child, his father's moods manifested in biting criticism over meaningless things and treacherous, silent evenings at home, when, for no reason at all, he would refuse to let Mikey out to play with his neighborhood friends. On these nights, Mikey would put himself to bed early, just to remove himself from his father's presence. He would close his bedroom window so that he would not be pained by the faraway voices of his friends. Alice, Sally, Lynn, Jimmy, and Sam became Mikey's friends when they were neighbor kids, all living on the same block, all seeking playmates as well as an escape from their own homes. The children claimed one of the abandoned homes on Ingram Street as their official meeting place, and the rusted mailbox mounted to the front door of the house read "The Gunners" in gold Mylar stickers. The house had been vacant for as long as any of them could recall, and they knew of no gunners in the neighborhood, so they took the place over and assumed its name as their own. They furnished the main room of the gunner house with items found on the side of the street: mildewed mattresses, throw pillows with cigarette stains, three-legged patio chairs, eyeless baby dolls, an artificial Christmas tree in such a tangle it took days to reassemble, They hung a flashlight from the center of the ceiling in this room, and it was in here that they invented jokes and games and secret languages, made plans, made trouble, badmouthed their parents, played cards, gambled, told stories, plotted against bullies, bickered, made up, luxuriated in boredom, and dreamed of the lives they would one day live, far from Lackawanna. As children, the Gunners could not have imagined that by the time they were 16 years old, one of them would turn her back on the others, and the group would be so fractured by the loss, the sudden and unexplained absence of this one, that within weeks the other friendships would also dissolve, leaving each of them in a dark and confounding solitude. Mikey Callahan became a sinkhole. Everything inside sort of loosened, and then just collapsed. Chapter 2. It was springtime, April, with 1 month left of her junior year of high school when Sally Forrest cut herself off from the rest of the Gunners. She stopped speaking to them at school, never again set foot in the Gunner house, would not answer them when they called to her in the hallway or when they tried to approach her as she walked down Ingram Street. She would quicken her pace and lower her eyes and change her route. She would not answer phone calls to her house. The rest of them finally went directly to her home to seek her out, where Sally's mother, Corinne, said that Sally was unwell and she would not allow the children to enter. Sally did not replace the group with new friendships at school. She seemed altogether uninterested in the company of others, taking her lunch outside or to a classroom that was not in use. She never raised her hand in class. Her pale eyes went cool, and her posture was hard. For several weeks, the others puzzled over the situation together, replaying recent conversations, devising theories, formulating vague and uncertain but genuine apologies. When they could not reach any single conclusion as to what might have caused Sally to turn on them, they began to turn on one another, with accusations and assumptions, resentment and suspicion. The Gunners found themselves behaving like strangers toward one another in the halls of school and the streets of Lackawanna for their remaining months of high school. Mikey was one grade behind the others in school, and the only one, aside from Sally, who remained in the area. Mikey moved out of his father's home after graduating high school into a tiny ranch house 12 miles north, so that his commute to General Mills, where he worked on the maintenance crew, would be 10 minutes instead of 30. He rented the ranch home from an elderly woman named Louise who had just moved into a retirement center. Louise explained to Mikey that her daughters had both married weasels, and she didn't have any plans of leaving the home to them, so Mikey should go ahead and do as he liked with the place, paint-wise, plant-wise, and pet-wise. Mikey brightened the dull gray-pink walls to a warm cream and planted a forsythia bush out front. He got a black kitten one Friday and named the cat Friday. After moving out of his father's home, Mikey made a habit of going to see his father every Sunday. His father would pour him a beer and they would stare tensely at the TV for a few hours. Then his father would get up to take a piss and say, "Lock the door on your way out." And Mikey would feel a great sense of relief. Mikey never left the area, or his job at General Mills, although he did receive 2 promotions over the course of a decade. He never left the ranch home either. He was shocked to find that Louise had actually left the house and all that it contained to him when she eventually passed. He hadn't realized she was so serious about those weasels. Mikey took Louise's impressive accumulation of Red Book magazines, erotic novels, and cookbooks to the Salvation Army, except for The Joy of Cooking, which he kept for himself. He paged absently through this book, many of its pages stained with sauce or textured with crumbs, until one day it began to interest him. He learned to baste and blanch and caramelize, poach and macerate and emulsify, learned the quick mental math of dividing recipes into a portion for one. He pored over Louise's collection from the classical repertoire on cassette tapes, listening to this music while he cooked and late into the evening. Friday became a dear and happy companion. He was a cat of the highest caliber. He purred when Mikey touched his head, while leaning and arching his back into Mikey's legs and walking figure eights through them as Mikey cooked. Purred in the morning when he moved from the foot of the bed, where he slept every night, to Mikey's chest, happily and dutifully kneading at Mikey's neck with his little black paws, purring so rapturously that he gasped and wheezed fishy breath into Mikey's face. Mikey wondered what had brought him the great fortune of having such a merry and contented cat, who, unlike Mikey, never seemed to slip into dark, pensive, and ungenerous moods. It was not long after Mikey left his father's home that his vision in his right eye began to grow worse. Faraway road signs, individual leaves on trees, and tiles on roofs were the first things to go. The change was so gradual that it wasn't until years later that he finally went to see an optometrist. The optometrist performed tests and gave Mikey a prescription for his right eye. He inquired as to when Mikey had lost vision completely in the left.
"I never had it," Mikey said.
"I see." The optometrist stared back and forth between both of Mikey's eyes and shone a bright blue light into the right one. Mikey picked out a pair of wire frames and reiterated to the receptionist ordering the glasses that he would only need the proper prescription in the right lens. Several months later, Mikey returned to the optometrist when he could tell his vision in his right eye had already grown worse. He was retested and given a stronger prescription. A year later, he was back again for the same reason. This time, the doctor asked about blind spots. Mikey confessed that he had several and asked what this meant. The doctor explained that he was undergoing early-onset macular degeneration. Mikey asked him directly, "Will I go blind?" The doctor answered directly, "Probably."
"When?"
The doctor compared Mikey's new prescription with the previous one. "A few years, most likely, although you never know what might happen with technology between now and then." Mikey felt an angry and fearful indignation shiver through the cold organs in his belly. He said, "Why is this happening?"
"Are you asking if it's hereditary?"
"I guess." "Possibly," the doctor said. Mikey was quiet for a bit. Then he said, "There was one time I looked directly at the sun when I was a kid." The doctor smiled gently. "They warn you about that, but it's almost impossible to cause permanent damage that way. You didn't do this to yourself, I can assure you of that." Mikey started to learn Braille. He started practicing to cook and clean and clothe himself with a piece of tape over his right eye. He also started to catalog images, colors, memories, and he created associations that would make sense to him when, if, he lost his sight. The color red equals the smell of cinnamon. Blue equals fingers under running water. White equals the taste of cream. A full moon is Chopin's Nocturne, Opus 9, Number 2. The first snowfall looks exactly the way sugar tastes. A tree-lined street with lampposts is Philip Glass's Metamorphosis 1. Excluding Sally, the rest of the Gunners started up a group email thread within a year or two of graduating high school and going their separate ways. Any ill will among the rest of them caused by Sally's absence seemed to have been forgotten. Although this was never formally acknowledged between them, they reconnected easily over email, the ongoing thread coming to life every few months, and their contact was warm, often containing a happy childhood memory or an ancient inside joke. With all of them now around 30, the past decade had seen a great deal of movement and change, all documented through these emails. Jimmy had come into great wealth since moving to Los Angeles at age 19 and making wise investments. Sam had been married at age 21 in a family-only ceremony and was now deeply involved with the church he and his wife attended in Georgia. Lynn had attended a music conservatory in New York City, but now lived in a small town in Pennsylvania, where she and her boyfriend ran the local AA chapter. Alice had attended the University of Michigan, eloped with a graduate student who she referred to as the Saint, been married to him for a year, and then divorced him. She now dated women. She currently owned a small but successful marina on Lake Huron. Sometimes, Mikey felt embarrassed by how little his own life had changed since high school compared to the rest of them. In their emails, the others described marriage and travels and concerts. In Mikey's emails, he described renovations to their high school gym, a new recipe he had attempted, and minor updates to Friday's health. On occasions when Mikey saw Sally Forrest out in Lackawanna, he had to fight his urge to report back to the others. As far as Mikey could tell, Sally remained in her mother's home after high school, and he continued to see her out from time to time, standing in line at the CVS pharmacy, massaging peaches at Tops, or walking up Ingram with a cell phone at her ear, although Sally always seemed to be listening, never speaking into that phone. Mikey did not know if she worked. He did not know if she had new friends or who spoke to her from the other end of that phone. With high school behind them and the others far away, Mikey had initially been hopeful that he and Sally might be able to reconnect, that she might finally reveal to him what had caused her to abandon the group, and that he might have the opportunity to apologize if he'd had any part of it. But when they encountered each other in public, Sally continued to look past Mikey with the same cold disdain she had when they were still in school, as though she'd never known him, as though they'd shared nothing. When he saw Sally, Mikey was filled with a dense, aching emptiness, one that contained so much. He longed to report to the others that their old friend Sally was still so, so thin. Perhaps had even lost weight since the last time he'd seen her. She always wore sunglasses, so he could not see her eyes. She carried a canvas bag with a fruit basket embroidered on it, and there was a large, bright yellowish stain on the strap. He still missed her, wondered about her, wondered what had gone wrong, and whether the others did too. But he always reasoned with himself that if the others cared, they would ask. No point picking at a sore and drawing fresh blood if everyone else was content to leave it be. There was often talk of a reunion between the five of them, but plans never came together. Even so, with brief and infrequent face-to-face contact, and all these years later, Mikey still considered Alice, Jimmy, Sam, and Lynn his dearest friends. He had trouble connecting with peers at work, and despised social events. He had not grown less shy over the years. He couldn't bring himself to start social media accounts because he hated all photographs of himself. Left eye always a bit creamy and strange and far away. Right eye focused, but never quite meeting the camera's lens, as though he feared its judgment. Cheeks always flaming, freckles overlaid with red. Cowlick always wild, as if it had an axe to grind. Mikey, therefore, always read the emails from the Gunners with great interest and felt deeply invested in their lives. He went on soaring Google Earth explorations through their towns, zooming around parks and downtowns and up and down residential streets. He made a habit of sending birthday cards, actual cards, via snail mail, to the others, who always expressed incredulous gratitude for the gesture. Mikey did not tell his friends that he might be going blind and was mining childhood relics. Yearbooks and journals and stacks of Polaroid photographs rubber-banded together, searching for pictures of his friends and meditating on them, knowing that these dear faces might one day elude him. In early January, the city of Buffalo was fossilized beneath 3 feet of hard gray snow. The air bitterly cold and humid. People moved slowly, like cogs in an old machine, muscles hard, cold, licking at their faces. Pipes had burst at General Mills, and Mikey was working 12-hour days. Mikey's 30th birthday came and went, with a text from Alice and a generic card from HR in his work mailbox, the typeface meant to resemble actual handwriting, acknowledging him as a valued employee and wishing him a special day. It was a week after Mikey's birthday that he received word of Sally's death. The news came from a colleague, someone who had attended Mikey's high school but who was several years younger than Mikey. The colleague had not known Sally, but news of a former student's suicide had reached him through the local news. Her body was found in the Buffalo River, less than a quarter mile downstream from the Buffalo Skyway. Her car was parked just off the entrance to the Skyway, an elevated steel bridge that soared 100 feet over the water beneath. Her mother had reported her missing late the night before. Although there was no note, it appeared to be a straightforward suicide. Her mother confirmed her struggle with depression. Video surveillance from the bridge showed that she acted alone just after midnight. Mikey's colleague realized that Sally would have been about Mikey's age, and he asked Mikey about it at work, wondering if Mikey had heard the news about his classmate, wondering if Mikey had known or would even remember the girl. "Her name was Sally," the guy said to Mikey. "Did you know a Sally?" Funeral arrangements were announced. It would take place in 2 weeks at St. Mary's, the church nearest Sally's mother's home, just 6 blocks off Ingram. Mikey was broken, muddled, distracted. He could think of nothing else, yet no matter how long and hard he thought on Sally, he could never reach her center. Furthermore, as he tried to recall memories of her, he realized he could never reach his own center. He could never reach something that felt entirely real or true. He began to wonder if he had no center. A hollow man. Mikey was in touch with Alice, Jimmy, Sam, and Lynn to make sure the news had reached them. They all planned to come to town for the service. Knowing that he would see the four of them brought Mikey some measure of solace, as well as nervous anticipation. Adulthood and years of living alone had taken a toll on his confidence. He wanted to believe that he would still be able to relate to his friends face to face, would still genuinely interest them, could offer comfort and share a laugh. But in pessimistic moments, he feared uneasiness between them brought on simply by the passage of time, too much life lived apart. In the days leading up to Sally's funeral, Mikey got a haircut and shoveled snow and vacuumed up Friday's hair. He often found himself short of breath, even when he had barely stirred. He avoided the Skyway, taking the long and indirect route north on Niagara Street instead. Several days before the funeral, Mikey received a call from Jimmy inviting him to a catered dinner following the funeral service at the lakeside vacation home not far from Lackawanna that Jimmy had purchased years earlier for his family. Jimmy said he would be inviting Alice, Lynn, and Sam as well. Jimmy said there were enough beds for everyone and all were welcome to spend the night. Mikey thanked Jimmy for the invite and said, "Can I bring something?" "Oh, God, no," Jimmy laughed bleakly. "Zappelli's catering the thing. There'll be enough for an army." Mikey said, "How are you holding up, bud?" Jimmy said, "I just can't believe she's gone. Again." It was quiet for a bit. Then Jimmy said in a strange voice, "I can't stop wondering. Well, do you know anything, Mikey?" Mikey's head felt way too heavy for his neck. Not right at all. His heart was loud. He had the strangest sensation, as if he were being pulled at, as if he were in someone else's dream. He stared out his window and saw that an enormous flock of grackles, there had to be 1,000 of them, maybe 10,000, had come to rest in the row of diseased-looking maple trees just on the other side of the street. Mikey got up, phone still at his ear, walked to his door, opened it, and stepped out into the snow. The air was thunderous, full and alive with the clamorous chatter and vibration of the birds. But moments later, when Mikey closed the door behind him, some of the birds nearest him were startled by the sound and took flight. Others followed. More. Mikey exhaled a white cloud, and his empty lungs tickled with cold. He coughed and watched the birds as they lifted off the trees in a magnificent ripple. It wasn't long at all until the entire flock had departed in a huge, spinning black cone, leaving only a blank and depleted void in their wake. An after sound. A holy, yearning silence, like a prayer that was too sad and too deeply felt to be spoken aloud. Mikey still held his phone at his ear, his lips now paralyzed by the cold, and Jimmy said, "Mikey, you there?" Mikey finally said, "I don't know." As these words slid out of his mouth, they felt long and cool, like snakes. Chapter 3. When Mikey started kindergarten, he was a shy boy who sat by himself on the bus while other children hollered and clapped and traded jokes and insults and items from their lunchboxes. Mikey watched out the window in the morning as other children were picked up from his street, and in the afternoon as they were dropped off. The Italian kid with eyes the color of a swimming pool, who hung out with the chubby blonde pink-faced kid whose R's came out like W's, the two of them always talking football, drawing out plays with smelly black markers, X's and swooping lines in a notebook. The tall, black-eyed girl with broad, high cheeks who ordered everyone else around, working in as many curse words and creative insults as possible. Butt slug. Ass face mouth breather. The freckled girl with the curly red hair who skipped recess to practice the piano in the music room. The slim, silver-haired girl who lived several doors up from Mikey. Usually, like him, she waited for the bus alone, but on rare occasion, her slim, silver-haired mother waited by her side. She typically sat by herself on the bus, too. Often, she sat in the seat directly behind Mikey, and sometimes he could hear her singing quietly to herself. One morning, this girl sat down directly next to him. As she sank into the seat, she said with low eyes, as though issuing an apology, "There are no more empty ones." She smelled very clean. She wore a green headband. Up close, Mikey could see that her hair was not actually silver, but the whitest blonde he had ever seen. So white that it took on the hue of other colors and lights around them. Her face was as pretty and delicate as lace. She arranged her backpack beneath her little legs. Mikey said, "It's okay." The girl sighed and touched the ends of her hair. He said, "What's your name?"
"Sally."
"I'm Mikey."
"You're a kindergartner?"
He nodded.
"What grade are you in?"
"First."
"Do you know how to read?"
"Mm-hmm."
"I don't yet."
"That's okay," Sally said.
"Is that your daddy who was soaping up the car?"
"What?"
"I saw a guy soaping up a car in your driveway the other day. A big old white car."
"Oh, yes," Mikey said. "That's him, and that's his car."
"Where's your mommy?"
Mikey said,
"I don't have one."
"Is she dead?"
Mikey thought.
"Maybe."
Sally was quiet for a moment. Then she said,
"My mommy says my daddy's a deadbeat and some other things."
"Is that the same as dead?"
"I don't think so."
Mikey said,
"Do you want a Jolly Rancher?"
"Yes."
Mikey offered her watermelon or grape or green apple. She took the green apple. She sucked on it silently, and her warm breath became sweet and strange. The next day, Sally sat next to Mikey once again, even though there were empty seats available, and the day after that, too. Usually, they didn't talk very much. The silence between them was easy, companionable. Sometimes, Sally placed her backpack on Mikey's lap, rested her head there, and slept. Mikey watched her sleeping face morph softly into and out of many expressions, and he tried to imagine what sort of dream produced each different one. Alice Clancy formed the group, really made it official, the summer between her first and second grade year. School had been out for only a week, and already Alice was bored of TV and fights with her older brothers over who got the first or last or largest portion of things. One afternoon, she wandered into the backyard of the greenhouse just a few doors down the block from her own, after she heard voices and laughter lifting up from behind the house. She caught sight of a ball in the air. She walked right to the center of things, between two boys wearing baseball gloves, and she stood there with her fists dug into her hips. She was 6 inches taller than either of them. "You boys ride my bus," she said. She looked back and forth between them. The chubby blonde kid punched his fist into his glove. He had round shoulders and a thin neck, and was the tiniest bit dim in the eyes. His nostrils and the thin, pale skin around his eye sockets was chafed pink, as though he cried a lot or had lots of allergies. He didn't wear a shirt. His belly was fat but firm, accentuated by a disturbing little outie. Alice said, "What's your names?" The black-haired, blue-eyed kid said, "Jimmy." His eyes were remarkable, as bright and interesting as tiny planets. The blonde kid said, "Sam, why are you at my house?"
"I'm Alice, and I live in the only brick house on the street, and we have that big black mutt named Jake."
She paused and jerked her chin over her shoulder in the direction of her house.
"Anyways, I have a club, and I'm president," she said. "Looking for members. You guys in or out?"
Sam said, "Who's in it?" Alice released an exasperated little noise and scowled at him.
"None of your beeswax," she said, "if you're not members."
Sam shoved his thumb toward Alice's face. "Look at my blood blister," he said.
Alice said, "Gross."
Jimmy said, "What do you do in your club?"
"Lots of secret stuff."
Sam tossed the baseball up and down to himself and said,
"Me and Jimmy need to talk it over. We'll let you know tomorrow."
Alice returned the following afternoon. Sam reported that they had talked it over and decided that they would join her club if she would let them play with Jake, her big black mutt.
Alice said, "Sure, but don't blame me if he snaps at you. He has some places he doesn't like when you touch."
Sam said, "So who else is in the club?"
Alice said, "I'm about to ask some other kids on the street. That little boy, the one who's a year younger and always sits with the white-haired girl on the bus, the two of them. And that red-haired girl who plays piano during recess."
Sam said, "Wait, so you don't have a club, you're starting one?" Jimmy added, "Like from scratch?"
"What difference does that make?"
Alice said, arms crossed, her tone both pushy and cavalier. Sam was quiet for a bit. Then he said,
"Can I be vice president?"
"What?"
"I want to be the vice president or we won't be in your club."
Alice considered this for a moment. Then she said,
"Fine, sure, whatever."
She turned to Jimmy. "You want to be something?" Jimmy blinked. His eyelashes were black feathers framing those blue eyes. He said, "Maybe like treasurer? I'm good at money."
Alice said, "Okay. We'll have that piano girl be the secretary, and the other two can just be there, unless they think up something special to be."
Alice, Sam, and Jimmy made their way up Ingram Street and successfully recruited Lynn, Sally, and Mikey. Alice had already scoped out the Gunner House as a potential gathering place, and they held their first official meeting later that afternoon. Alice brought her mutt, Jake, and a slotted spoon in case he pooped inside. "His bowels are rotten," she explained. Sam dragged in a taxidermied sheep's head that he had found on the curb just up the block. The place smelled strongly of mildew and cat piss, and dust hung thick and motionless in the hot, hot air above the children's sweating heads and their eager, happy voices. Chapter 4. When Sally was 8 years old, she and Mikey decided to walk all the way to Gasser Park. It was August. They were the only Gunners who weren't either enrolled in Bible school at St. Mary's Parish or away at summer camp in Ellicottville on this particular week. Sally and Mikey had both been to the park before, but never without a parent. They knew that it was far to walk, but that they would reach the park if they took Ingram to Lakeshore, then followed that east for a long while. They filled a backpack with ham and mustard sandwiches, Fritos, Twizzlers, and a canteen of water. They had all day to make it there and back. Sally's mother would not be home from work until after 5, much later than that if she went out drinking with one of her boyfriends, and Mikey's father would return around 7. Both Sally and Mikey were already capable at this very young age of letting themselves in and out of their homes using a key. At Mikey's home, this key lived under the doormat. At Sally's, it was in a fake football-sized rock that opened and closed on a hinge. It took them an hour to reach the park. Along the way, they talked about the upcoming school year. Sally told Mikey what he could expect from all the different teachers. She told him about the live crab that lived in Mrs. O'Casey's classroom and all the amazing facts about animals he would learn in her class. How ostriches can run faster than a horse, and that male ostriches roar like a lion. She told him about the strange and unpredictable migration of the snowy owl. She told him about the wood frog, which didn't hibernate like other animals, but instead buried itself in the ground and allowed itself to freeze. "It stops breathing," Sally said. "Its heart stops beating." Mikey said, "But it's not dead?"
"Nope," said Sally. "In the springtime, or whenever it wants to come back into the world, it thaws with the ground and its heart beats again."
Mikey stopped when they passed a bed of clover along the side of the road, and he showed Sally how to pluck the tiny white-purple petals from the stem, how to bite on the inner tip, which was damp and sweet and edible. Sally loved spending time with Mikey. He never seemed to have a nasty opinion about anything. Like her, he seemed equally satisfied to talk or not talk, and he never asked hard questions. This suited Sally just fine. There were things she didn't want to talk about, things that Mikey would never think to ask. It was quiet outside, and very hot. When they finally reached the park, Sally felt grown up and accomplished, and she gazed around the parking lot and picnic area, seeking some sort of acknowledgement for the thing they had just done. There was only one car in the lot, a dusty old powder-blue Crown Victoria, and no one else in sight. The two of them stared at a large map of the park behind plexiglass. They filled their canteen at the nearby fountain, then followed the trail leading to Turtle Pond, where they had decided to eat their lunch. Turtle Pond was the size of a football field. The water was army green, and the air smelled of burned grass and sewage. Dragonflies skirted through reeds, and a black flip-flop was stuck upright in the muck. A charred Budweiser can floated aimlessly a little ways out. They stood at the edge of the pond for a minute, looking for turtles, then took a seat in the shade and ate their hot, damp, and deformed sandwiches and opened the chips. Mikey ate a Frito, then inhaled sharply and pointed out at the water. "Turtle," he whispered. A little black head bobbed casually at the surface, 6 feet out from the edge of the pond. They rose to get a closer look.
"It's okay, fella," Mikey whispered. "You're so good, fella."
Sally could see down through the surface of the water that it was a box turtle, its shell no more than 6 inches in length. Its wary little half-closed eyes were sleepy and annoyed. Mikey inched a bit closer, Fritos in hand.
"I've got something for you, pal," he said,
tossing a chip in the turtle's direction so that it landed at the water's surface just inches from its face. The turtle's head instantly dipped below the water, but a moment later, the chip disappeared, snatched from underneath. Mikey giggled. The sun was on his face, and his pale eyes were all iris, the color of honeydew melon. Sally tossed another chip in, and the same thing happened. Mikey tossed in another one, this time a little bit closer in their direction, luring the turtle toward shore. Mikey said, "I'm going to catch him if he comes close enough." He took a very slow step into the silt at the water's edge, and his foot sank into it, a puddle quickly forming around his shoe. He took another step into the water, and then both feet were fully submerged. The turtle disappeared, and Mikey tossed 5 or 6 chips in a wide arc in that direction. He took another step in. Sally said, "Don't you want to take your shoes off?" Mikey said, "No, there might be a leech. Then we'd have to burn it off before it sucked all my blood out. The water feels good anyhow. Might keep my feet cool on the way back." Mikey took another big step out into the water so that it reached his calves. He laughed and made a face. "It is so squishy," he said. He looked like he was having fun, and Sally liked his idea about keeping cool with wet shoes, so she decided to follow him in. Soon the water reached her knees. She said, "Maybe I'll get my shorts a little wet." Mikey said, "Might as well." Now, when Sally took a step, it was in slow motion, because the effort of lifting a foot out of the soft muck was so great. It felt weird and exciting. Soon the water was at her hip. The mud was above her ankles. She suddenly noticed that Mikey was struggling. He was no longer laughing. His face had changed. He gripped the back of one knee with both hands as though to pry it up and out. Sally said, "Are you okay?" "I'm stuck," he said. "I can't move either of my feet. And I think I'm sort of sinking." As soon as he said this word, Sally realized that she, too, was stuck and nearly sinking.
"Okay," Sally said. "Here, let's..."
And she tried the same move, pulling on her hamstring with both hands, but this did nothing. Mikey said,
"Here, why don't we..."
And he struggled mightily, finally releasing one of his legs. He splashed backward into the water. With one foot out, he was soon able to finagle the other one out, too, and he paddled over to Sally. He reached into the water beneath her with his hands, trying to help. She held on to his head for balance. She felt him clawing at her legs, but before long, Mikey had gotten himself stuck again. The mud was crawling up Sally's legs like a snake coiling up a tree. The water suddenly looked as thick and black as ink. Mikey said, "Don't worry." But Sally could see that he was starting to panic too. They held one another's arms for combined strength and balance, but the more they worked to free themselves, the faster they sank. The water was past Sally's waist. They called for help, hollering back toward the lot, but their little voices were lost in humidity that was as thick as a pillow. Then the water was at Sally's ribs. It smelled hot and raw and bad in her nostrils. Sally said, "I don't want to die." She sobbed into the crook of her elbow. She thought of her mother and the possibility that she could come rescue them, and realized her mother wouldn't even notice her absence until sundown, much later than that if she was out with a boyfriend. And even if her mother had been right there with them, it occurred to Sally she had little faith that her mother would know what to do. Her mother was not the most sensible person. Then Sally thought of her father, way up in Canada. Even though she didn't know him much at all, had never even met him face to face, she was almost certain he'd know what to do. But he was so far away. Sometimes her birthday cards from him arrived 3 weeks late. That's how far away he was. Given how difficult it seemed to get in touch with her father, Sally wondered now how long it would take someone to get a hold of him to deliver the news that his daughter had drowned in mud. She wondered if he would cry. For some reason, the thought of her father's tears sent a strong and fast pulse beating straight to the private place between her legs. Mikey said, "I'm going under. I'm going to find my shoes with my hands, untie them, get my feet out." He disappeared under the surface of the water. Bubbles rose above him, and a bloated Frito drifted by. Then Mikey burst upward, coughing, eyes round and wet-lashed, hair darkened and plastered to his head in spikes. He let out a sharp, barking cough. "I got out." He emerged from the mud. He dove down again beneath Sally. She could feel him scratching at her left ankle, excavating, gripping her foot. She could tell it was going to work. She felt a sweet, glorious swell inside of her, an uncomplicated and unprecedented sense of reprieve. She was going to make it. Her mother would not have to come looking for her after all, would not have to pick out a funeral dress. Her father would not have to maybe cry. Once they were out of the water, they panted and trembled and laughed in high, soft pitches. They rinsed the mud from their legs and hands. Sally pulled a small twig from Mikey's hair. They opened the Twizzlers. Sally's knees were starting to grow a little hair on them, and she noticed now how the fuzz shimmered in the sun. They walked back up the trail, which was covered in acorn shells and stickery brambles, then walked up Lakeshore under a punishing sun, through ditches when the gravel on the shoulder of the road became too hot or too sharp. By the time they reached Ingram Street, their feet were brown and bloodied, and they were exhausted, weak, sunburned, out of water. They stopped in at Bakery Shapansky, which shared a parking lot with the Clean Machine Laundromat, Benny's Liquor Store, and Gary's Grocery and Delicatessen. The woman who owned the bakery would give the children free baked goods that had expired that day if they caught her before closing time. They called her Babcia, Grandma in Polish. The skin of her face was as crisscrossed with lines as an old cutting board. Her bakery was decorated with framed photographs of dairy farms in Poland that had all faded to bluish gray. On this day, Babcia provided Mikey and Sally with water and sesame cookies, and she scolded them for losing their shoes. When they finally reached home, they drank grape sodas on Mikey's back porch, put band-aids on their feet, then sacked out on the couch. Mikey fell asleep 5 minutes into an episode of ALF. Sally looked around the room. Mikey's house was so clean and quiet, it was like a tomb. Sally wondered if Mikey's dad ever brought girlfriends home. Mikey had said something very strange at one point on their walk home. He had fallen quiet for a long while, then said, "My dad might have been gladder if I didn't make it out of the mud." Sally said, "What? Why?" "I don't think he loves me very much," Mikey said, and Sally noticed that Mikey was nodding as he said this. Sally stared at him. "He has to," she said. "It's a rule of being a mommy or daddy." Sally didn't know how she knew this, but it seemed like a true thing. Mikey said, "Okay," and he continued to nod. Sally watched Mikey's sleeping face now and realized how many times over the years she had slept next to Mikey on the bus, because she slept more soundly on the bus than she did in her own home, how often Mikey had seen her sleeping face. Yet this was the first time she had ever seen his. His expression was as empty as the moon. The tiniest droplets of sweat decorated his nose. His cheeks were the color of bubblegum, and his dime-sized cowlick, as always, invited a little clockwise swirl of the finger. It seemed inconceivable to Sally that this was the face of the person who had saved her life. Chapter 5. It was the third week of January, and the crust of yellowy-gray snow that had encased the city of Buffalo earlier that month had received a dusting overnight, an inch of fresh crystal powder. The air was clean and quiet and wondrous, the sky a pale bowl. It was Sunday. Mikey arrived at St. Mary's Cathedral 30 minutes before Sally's 3 o'clock service. The lobby was dark and smelled like the inside of a sweaty old baseball cap. Mikey hung his coat and brushed snowflakes from his hair. There were a dozen people in the lobby, older folks, friends of Sally's mother, Mikey guessed. In the low light, grim and tucked within layers of black clothing, everyone there looked severe and vaguely bloodless. The priest was a flaccid-looking individual with a sad, high forehead, and he offered Mikey a nod that was both wary and polite. Mikey's hands were frigid because he hadn't worn gloves, and he stuffed them into his pockets, where they met his thighs and sent goosebumps to his groin. Mikey considered whether he ought to make attempts at mingling or disappear to walk through quiet basement hallways and avoid speaking with anyone until his friends arrived. He was tempted by the thought of dark halls, dark classrooms, janitor's closets, drinking fountains mounted low on the wall. His low-grade anxiety was brought quickly to the surface by any sort of social interaction, much less one taking place in a church, and under this sort of circumstance. He felt anxious, shaky, hollow. He wore a dark gray suit from JCPenney and a poorly knotted blue tie. His armpits felt cold and stiff, suggesting wetness. In the mirror that morning, his pale eyes had looked wet and muddled, as if they were lost, had been placed inside the wrong head. Mikey made his way across the lobby to a small coffee setup. He filled a styrofoam cup with coffee that was not steaming, and he stirred in a packet of sugar. A chill nipped at him. Had he locked the door to his home? He had left extra food out for Friday, but was it enough? His fingernails were unclean. What would his friends think of him? Had he grown ugly and weird in the last decade? Had he grown old? Mikey sipped his coffee, which was thin and cool, and tried to reach a relaxed pose as he gazed around the lobby. He drew his phone from his pocket and glanced at it for the time and notifications. Jimmy had called several hours earlier to say that his connecting flight was delayed and he was stranded in Denver. He had rebooked for later that day, but would miss the funeral service. He said that the catering arrangements were already made at the lake house. Mikey and the others should head there without him. Mikey's phone showed no update from Jimmy or any of the others. He slid it back into his pocket and breathed hot air into his fists, since the coffee had not warmed his fingers. He was bothered by his cold hands. It seemed like the sort of thing a person would remember about another person, especially when there was little else to say about him. The man with cold hands. Mikey glanced over toward the door where, mercifully, Lynn was entering. He adjusted his glasses to make sure it was her, and it was. Lynn wore a puffy green coat that nearly grazed the floor, and her head was small and pale within an explosion of curly red hair. She was with a very tall and handsome man whose bald head gleamed with moisture. As the man helped Lynn remove her coat, she caught sight of Mikey across the room. Lynn straightened up in recognition. Her face broke into delight, and she called, "It's you!" She bounced on her toes and clapped her hands together fast and happy for a moment, then stopped, abruptly conscious of her display of joy in the somber room. Mikey made his way over to the two of them. Lynn was very thin, and her face was pocked with scars that Mikey did not remember, but her smile was generous and straightforward, her green eyes lively. For the first time in days, Mikey felt warm. Lynn said, "Sorry to make a scene, but I don't care if it's a funeral. Mikey, you're a sight. A
This makes me happy.
Can't believe how long it's been.
This is my boyfriend, Isa.
Her red curls were so tight, it was as if each one had been formed around a pencil. Her nose